Long, long time ago, we used to get our food homegrown, but now that's just a memory. Used to be we'd shop with these, never would eat antifreeze. We'd plan to go on living quite a while. But now our goods are all delivered from someplace up the Yangtze River. No one knows the source there, so you might find some horsehair. And if corporations make a buck, then they don't give a flying. Peking duck. And with this system we get stuck. Today it makes you sigh. Cause when you buy an American pie, now your granny didn't bake it, it was made in Shanghai. With the apples engineered to be juicy, not dry, but the crust is made of cardboard and lye. I don't feed it to your dog, he might die. Oh, did you eat a tasty cake? And did it make your stomach ache? I guess I could have told you so. And the reason that you're looking wan is some guy took bribes in Sichuan, and you just ate a little piece of toe. And all those toys you bought from Fisher Price have toxins deemed unsafe for mice, and Elmo tends to wheeze because he's laced with the PCBs. But all my problems seem so far when I hold my new cheap DVR. I'd even chew that gum called guar. It's plain to see that I'll buy stuff for a young guy. I drove a Chevy, but it's heavy and the price is too high. Soon $20 will get you a new car from Shanghai. And honey, that will be the day that we die.
Thanks for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. Today's program is Culture Wars. Authors talk about their books on contemporary cultural issues and respond to questions from the audience. The panel is moderated by Aaron Audbury Kaplan and includes Nancy L. Cohen, Eric DeGans, and Karen Sternheimer.
Starting at down there.
Far left.
No.
Far left. I like that phrase.
Nancy L. Not, politically.
No muttering. Nancy L. Cohen. We have Eric Deggans and Karen Sternheimer. I'm going to introduce them in just a moment. But I just wanted to talk a little bit about the concept of culture war. I started thinking about what is it? What is a culture war? And it turns out pretty much everything. Because it is how we now frame pretty much every issue in this country. And I just was startled to stop and think, how did that happen? Abortion and I have a whole list here from Wikipedia. Stem cell research, right to die, legal drinking age, decriminalization, harm reduction, capital punishment, law and order, separation of church and state. All of these things are framed as good, one side or the other, one side or the other. We've all heard about this polarization for a long time. So we're going to talk about how we got there and what we can expect in the future. So I'll do a proper introduction now. Nancy, back to my far left. Nancy Cohen is a historian, journalist, and author of 3 books on American politics. She's been published in the LA Times, Playboy, RollingStone.com, other publications, and she's currently a visiting fellow at Occidental College, and her latest book is called Delirium, How the Sexual Counter-Revolution is Polarizing America. So welcome, Nancy.
Thank you.
Eric Deggans. He is a TV media critic for the Tampa Bay Times. He does commentary for NPR. He also writes on sports media for National Sports Journalism Center. And he was named as one of the most influential black Americans by Ebony Magazine. And this is his first book, and it's called Race Baiter, How the Media Wields Dangerous Words to Divide a Nation. So welcome, Eric, all the way from Florida. Last but hardly least is Karen Sternheimer. Karen is a sociologist at USC, right here. She writes about media and society, and this book is her fourth book. One of her previous books is called Celebrity Culture and the American Dream, Stardom and Social Mobility. She has been a contributor to Huffington Post, New York Times, LA Times, and other publications. So welcome, Karen. And her current book is called Connecting Social Problems and Popular Culture, Why Media is Not the Answer. I'm sorry, I'm working backwards here. I forgot to tell you, please silence your cell phones during this session. And following the panel, there will be a book signing. And the book signing for this panel is located at signing area 1. And it's on the map. I'm not entirely sure where that is, but that's where the signing will be. And you are not allowed to record this session. Okay. So before we get started, I just wanted to read some excerpts from each book. And I really recommend them all. And my own book, but I'm not, you know, won't talk about that. And there's a lot of overlap here between race baiting, the feminist counter-revolution, and the role of the media in driving everything. And in Eric's book, early in the book, he says... His basic premise is that TV, that media is really very niche these days. We all know that. It's very, very targeted at certain audiences. And he writes, today's fastest growing media platforms now focus on smaller segments of the audience, the plumpest parts of a seriously fragmented viewing, reading, listening public. And one way to ensure that those audience segments develop fierce loyalty is to feed them messages demonizing other outlets and the groups who might gather there. It may sound cynical, but in a fragmented media culture, hate sells. And he ties that all to race. And in Nancy's book, Delirium, How the Sexual Counter-Revolution is Polarizing America, fascinating book, and she actually takes you back to 1972. How many of you remember the campaign, presidential campaign in 1972? Well, not too many. Okay, well... she actually is giving us the history of sort of the backlash, the conservative backlash to a lot of issues, and this is the what she calls a sexual counter-revolution. And she quotes, in 1972, George Meany, who was then the head of the AFL-CIO, who was very much against George McGovern, who was then the presidential nominee, who died this past year. And there was a great deal of alarm about George McGovern opening the door for, you know, homosexuals and blacks and all. There was a lot of fear around that at that time. So George Meany she quotes him as saying at that 1972 convention in Miami, we listen to the gay lib people, you know, the people who want to legalize marriages between boys and boys and legalize marriages between girls and girls. We heard from the abortionists and we heard from the people who looked like Jacks, acted like Jills, and had the odor of Johns about them. And it sounds eerily like how we're talking now about the same issues. Okay, and finally, Karen's book, which is very interesting, because we always like to blame the media for so many things. It's always the media's fault, right, for perpetuating all sorts of immoral things. And in her book, she talks about how we have to think about the influence of media on young people is something we worry about, right? The young people. And she has a section in her book where she talks about the whole notion of childhood and why, you know, how that came about, why we have to protect it. And so she says... In her book, she's talking about how we actually created the concept of childhood and adolescence after the Great Depression. Apparently before the Depression, there were only adults. After the Depression, we had leisure time, we were more relaxed, and suddenly there was the youth market. And she writes, the shared space of high school led to the creation and growth of youth culture. Young people's taste in music grew to bear more resemblance to their peers than their parents. Parents complained that young people wasted their time listening to the music and were not as industrious as prior generations, a reflection of children's exclusion from the labor force and increase in leisure time. This was particularly true following World War II, when economic prosperity coupled with mass marketing created even more distinction between what it meant to be a child, a teenager, and an adult. And she goes on to say that we now, you know, we are so afraid of what the media does to young minds. So that's my introduction to you all. And so we can just open it up, and any one of you can start and perhaps talk a little bit about, you know, the scope of your book and what you were trying to get at. Any volunteers?
Oh, I can start. Okay.
You can.
Basically, the premise of this book is that I think a lot of people's view of media has not kept pace with the actual form of media. Our view of how media outlets become successful is that they get the biggest audience. And that was true 5 years ago, 10 years ago. But now the way media becomes successful is they focus on the biggest small niches of audience, and they super serve that audience. I call it the tyranny of the broad niche. So if you're Comedy Central, you're focused on young white males. If you're Lifetime, that's your home for Women in Peril movies for middle-aged women. You know, it's just every cable channel and media platform has their audience that they're super serving. But there are some platforms that use prejudice and stereotypes and outright racism to draw in an audience and keep that audience from going to other platforms. So Fox News Channel, to use one example, doesn't just say that we're the best at covering news. They say the other outlets will lie to you. They are liberally biased. They are corrupt. And in that way, they try to insulate and bring in their audience and keep that audience from migrating to other platforms. And I always tell people when I give lectures, if you want to understand 95% of what happens in media, someone's losing money or somebody's making money. So look at where the money-making potential and imperative is in media, and you understand why prejudice and stereotypes rear their ugly heads in different ways.
You can listen to great speeches and interviews on accesssacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
Big business cares about little people. You're getting sleepy. Polar bears are overrated. You're getting sleepy. Fiscal responsibility demands that we ignore the cost of Bush's tax cuts and two wars. Now when I count to three and snap my fingers, you'll awake refreshed and vote Republican. Iran's a threat to peace, so we should bomb them. You're getting sleepy. Elizabeth Warren is too altruistic to be trusted. Sleepy. We called it the Pledge to America because we're simply dusting off the contract with America, because that worked so well. And now when I count to three and snap my fingers, you'll awake confused and vote Republican. Mexicans are taking American jobs, which we could be outsourcing to Sri Lanka. Jesus loves America best. That's why he wrote the Bible in English. Scalia, Thomas, Roberts, and Alito hate judicial activism, and so they gave all the rights of personhood to Walmart. Now when I count to three and snap my fingers, Republican. Ooh, I want to see Titanic 2. Ooh, 'cause I love watching the same disaster over and over. Louis Gohmert will protect us from terror babies. Sleepy. Republicans gave us civil rights. So sleepy. Newt Gingrich should decide who can and cannot be married. Sarah Palin, bring on the rapture. Whatever happens outside my gate is not my problem. I vote Republican. The best social safety net is debtor's prison. So vote Republican. You can't wrap your head around the fact that the footprint of in-transition human capital demonstrates you lack the skill set and bandwidth needed to provide impactful throughput to effectively brand the current failure cascade in the knowledge economy space. And science is confusing. Now when I count to three and snap my fingers, you'll remember nothing. And vote Republican. You're getting sleepy. You're counting sheep and getting sheepy. Lullaby.
I'm looking at media in a different way, whereas you're looking more at news media or what passes for news media. One of the things that I look at in my work is fears that we have about media. And I think what's especially relevant for our topic on the culture wars is that culture wars are often fought on the backs of children. The things that are allegedly harmful to children kind of amp up this sense that we're fighting a battle between good and evil. And what I've looked at in my work is how the media itself, and I don't necessarily mean the news media here, but whether it's video games, television, movies historically, now we're seeing more concerns about texting and other social networking, that somehow it is these new forms of media that are in some ways corrupting not just children, but our culture more generally. And as Aaron read from my book, one of the things that I write about and think a lot about is how what has really changed in especially the last century is what we expect the experience of childhood to be like. So certainly there were people who were called children 100 years ago, but we wouldn't have expected them to stay in school for very long. If they would have gone to school, say, beyond the eighth grade, that would have been somewhat exceptional. And we also, especially in large cities, would have expected children to experience things like, I don't know, seeing prostitutes in public places. We would have expected that they would have been witness to death, perhaps in their own home, perhaps of a sibling. And so in part, these culture wars that we hear a lot about, and many of them that Aaron listed, are kind of characterized as things that are harmful to children. And I think that's what really amps up the adrenaline for people when they, if they choose to take a side in these so-called wars.
Yeah, and I just want to add that the overlay to all the culture wars you just talked about is the element of religion, you know, in Christianity, which, again, is a big topic these days.
Hi, so I am here on the sex, gays, and women beat. Not much on media. So
I have some sex and gays in this book, too.
So do I.
Well,
so
everybody
I.
has
it's
to,
here.
Right?
Yeah.
But there's a lot of overlap, like I said.
So I want to take us back briefly to a year ago in the midst of the election. Remember the birth control panic and aspirin between the knees as contraception, Slutgate, transvaginal probes. Then, you know, the summer came along and we were told by a number of Republican Senate candidates that women didn't get pregnant from rape, that is, if it was a legitimate rape. And no, the Senate candidate in Indiana disagreed. No, of course women can get pregnant from rape. But God intended that. So I don't know, ladies, if anybody else felt like it was getting really crowded down there around the time of the election. So everybody agreed that this was insane, delirium, right? So millions of people were unemployed. We still are in Afghanistan. But here, the world's most powerful country was debating birth control in the 21st century. Right now, so actually, I think that we should thank Rush Limbaugh and the GOP rape denialists and Mitt Romney, who could never quite decide whether he supported equal pay for women or not. So basically, their shadow movement came out of the closet for all of us to see, and everybody was suitably appalled. So the election last year was supposed to be about the economy, and it became an election about sex and women and gays. So the question is, why? So as we in Los Angeles know here, there is always a backstory. And that's what my book Delirium covers. The backstory of our culture wars, the backstory of the politics of sex in America. So the book tells a story about how a small minority of reactionaries, who frankly are obsessed with controlling the sex lives of other people, hijacked American politics. And the book, as Aaron said, takes us back to 1972, which frankly I don't remember. I'm a historian. That's how I wrote about it. It takes us back through what I call the sexual counter-revolution. and argues that this sexual counter-revolution, a reaction against feminism and gay rights and the sexual revolution, has been kind of played the starring role in driving our political polarization. So, you know, if you want to think about the kind of mysterious and confounding episodes of our recent politics, you know, where did these clowns in the 2012 GOP primary come from? Why was Bill Clinton impeached over a consensual sexual affair? How did George Bush win the 2000 election? What made John McCain think that Sarah Palin would be a good vice president? So what I argue is that it's all revealed by understanding how the what I call the sexual fundamentalists have taken over the Republican Party from bottom to top. So I feel like when we know this backstory, all the sex, gays, lady parts become clear. It wasn't a distraction. It wasn't a sideshow. It reflected what the right wing of the Republican Party truly believes and truly cares about. So the way this played out in the election isn't the way that many people have often assumed it would in the culture wars. Probably most of you know that Obama won women by about 10 or 11 points. But consider this. If women had split their votes equally between Romney and Obama, Romney would have won the election by 3 million votes. So you would think that Republicans would have gotten the message. Actually, no. So in Ohio this week, while the rest of the country is focused on what's happening in Boston, the Senate GOP committee introduced a bill banning teachers from talking about, quote, gateway sexual activity in sex ed class. And this is a piece of legislation that actually includes the words erogenous zones in the legislation. There have been dozens of anti-abortion bills introduced since the 2012 election, and they're speeding through in red states. And of course, we have the gay marriage ruling coming soon. So I think the most important takeaway is that this anti-gay, anti-abortion, anti-women kind of faction that has really taken over the Republican Party is less popular than people think, or you would think they are based on watching Fox News, but more powerful than their numbers warrant. I calculate that they're about 13 to 17% of the population. So what's the fix? One of the important ways to fix this is for the mainstream, which, you know, the center is now culturally progressive. We know that a majority support gay marriage. We know that close to two-thirds of Americans do not want Roe v. Wade overturned. So, but everybody has to stay tuned in and involved. Because this small minority is very smart electorally, and they tend to win in low turnout elections. The second thing is, if we want the dysfunction and the paralysis in Washington to end, the GOP needs to return to its roots. And its roots are pro-women's rights and pro-civil rights for African Americans and pro-privacy, pro-small government when it comes to personal matters. Now, I think eventually this will happen, but don't hold your breath. Come, you masters of war. You who build all the guns. You that build all the planes. You that build the big bombs. You that hide behind walls. You that hide behind desks. I just want you to know I can see through your masks. You've never done nothing but build to destroy. You play with my words like it's your little toy. You put a gun in my hand and you hide from my eyes. And you turn and run faster when the fast bullets fly. Like Judas of old, you lie. A world war can be won
see through your eyes and to see through your brain, like I see through the water that runs down my dreams. You've thrown the worst fear that can ever be hurled, a fear to bring children into the world.
Now for something completely different.